three pines, planted by a loving father. One for himself, one for his wife, one for his first daughter, to grow as she grew. The actual trees no longer exist. They were chopped down, destroyed, like so much else in the life of this family.
It was such a terrible thing that happened. People that can do something that evil, you think that they'd look evil and that you'd recognise it, but you don't.
It was like an out-of-body experience, because I just remember just falling to my knees on the floor.
This is the story of murder most brutal, a betrayal of love by those you'd expect to trust the most.
Their actions had caused them to be sentenced to more time in prison than had actually been alive.
A story, too, of how unwittingly the guilty can leave evidence, laying bare the inner workings of a crime when violence explodes after years of tension. Wales, a coastline of grandeur, resorts filled with comfortable bed and breakfasts and hotels, a hint of the sedate, of Time Warp maybe. A perfect setting for the Colwyn Bay antiques business run by the family of Tony Robinson, son of a Polish immigrant. He started working here in his teens.
My dad worked for his father as a French polisher, and we had a shop which they acquired after my grandfather escaped a prisoner of war camp and came to Wales.
His passion lay elsewhere.
My dad was a really big football fan. He had trials with Crystal Palace and Man United Boys. He played up and down North Wales for every team, managed them after, and every pub on every corner. He also was the youngest player to score for North Wales.
He was a popular figure among the women of the town.
He was quite a catch, I suppose, back then. Mainly it was because the family had a large business, so they were quite well known as a family in such a small town. And also because he was a footballer, I think, and he was always very fit. And he had really nice hair, my dad. He always had really nice hair.
He met the girl who was to become his first wife, Susan, when they were teenagers. Their daughter, Mandy, was born in 1969, and a few years later, Tony and Susan married. He built her the bungalow, calling it Three Pines.
He planted the three pine trees, because it was me and my mum and my dad. And I just remember him saying, you know, this will grow as you grow.
In fact, barely were the trees planted when the family became four. A second daughter, Claire, was born. But the romantic dream was already fading.
My mum put up with a lot because of his character and how he was, you know, seen as such like a ladies' man.
Mainly, it was my dad's drinking at the weekends after football. And in the week, I suppose she didn't see him anyway because he worked really hard. I think she wanted a bit of weekend family time, but that would interfere with his playing the football and watching the football and being with the lads, I suppose.
See you tomorrow.
Cheers.
Bye.
Cheers.
In 1979, when Tony was 30, he and Susan split up.
He definitely suffered a breakdown. You know, when my mum did leave with both those girls.
No, I'm not!
I'm not waiting anymore! Come on, we've got to go, sweetheart!
Mandy was 10. The day her parents split still haunts both sisters.
You don't have to break up, it's all your fault!
It's not...
Yes, it is, though!
I remember my mum telling me how Mandy absolutely hated her. She tied herself to the washing machine with her skipping rope and, I was only very young.
You don't have to break up.
But to Mandy, he was like Father Christmas. You know, he'd wake her up early hours of the morning and they'd go mushroom picking and he would teach her about how to catch rabbits and things like that.
I think that's an interesting thing.
This one piece will make 52 layers.
Watch on mobile devices or the big screen. All for free. No subscription required.
Like that one.
Yeah, it's nice and bright then, isn't it?
The daughters and their mother ended up living in Farnborough, in Hampshire. Tony went to live in a flat in Colwyn Bay, owned by his brother, and sold Three Pines to his parents. He travelled south frequently to see his daughters in Farnborough.
I don't think I moved from the windowsill until I saw his van come round, and I almost, you know, I didn't kiss anybody goodbye. I was out the door before, you know, they could even catch me kind of thing. It was lovely seeing him. It would upset me. He would always talk about my mum and ours as a family and how much he still missed us.
He never really seemed to get over it or understand how she could have left him and took us away.
But as years passed, Tony wasn't entirely lonely. He still had plenty of attention from women.
I don't play anymore. I coach for Colwyn Bay.
He knew all the ladies and they knew him and they knew his whereabouts and who he was going out with or not going out with. And he was still seen as a catch. And even though, you know, he's our dad, he was a really handsome, attractive man.
Soon, Tony would embark on a new relationship with a new chance of happiness. No way of foreseeing the ultimate betrayal and tragedy which lay ahead. It's 1984, and Tony Robinson, aged 35, has split with the wife with whom he shared his dream bungalow. His two daughters have gone to live with her. He's single, eligible, and meets a girl much younger than him in his local pub.
Ooh, looks like you could do with a drink.
Joanne Barr was just 19.
That would be nice, thank you.
I think, now looking back, she knew what she was doing. I think she had designs on him. He told me that she had picked him out.
By now, Claire was 9, Mandy was 15. The arrival of a 19-year-old in the household soon led to rivalry.
Just leave me alone, Jeb.
She was quite nice until they moved in together, and then she tried to boss me about and tell me what I could or I couldn't do.
But the daughters didn't get the support they expected from their father.
All of a sudden, he was doing what she was saying, and we couldn't understand why, really.
He didn't want to upset Joanne by having a go at her about the way she treated us. So we soon learned that you didn't bother my dad about it, because if there was a problem, she made it difficult for us to see him.
When Mandy was 18 years old, she passed her driving test and drove 260 miles to Wales to surprise her dad.
Dad? It's me!
I didn't ring Dad. And say I was coming, I'll admit that. And I must have turned up there about 5, 6 o'clock that evening.
It's me! Ta-ra!
What do you want?
I've passed the test! Is Dad in?
He's asleep. Mandy, you know I can't wake him.
Well, can I come in?
No, he's asleep.
The next day, went to the shop to see my dad and obviously gave him a piece of my mind. And I don't think we spoke properly, really, for about 3 years after that.
Claire stayed in touch with her father. Mandy and Tony became increasingly distant. In 1991, 7 years after Tony and Joe met, Mandy received some news. Tony and Joe had a baby girl, Ashley.
No, I am. I'm happy for you. Well, I didn't even know she was pregnant.
Obviously, I was annoyed that he hadn't rung and told us. I was hurt, definitely at the time. But I was excited as well that you had a new little baby sister.
Tony moved with Joe back into Three Pines, the bungalow he'd originally built for his wife, Susan. And before long, Ashley was joined by a sister, Holly.
It was like he was trying to recreate the same family again, trying to have a second chance at the same life. I did find it spooky. I used to look at her and think, why would you want to do that?
Several years passed.
Oh, I can't wait to wear my new skirt.
That's if we can convince Dad to get us them first.
Yeah, we can. I'm going to wear it.
The youngest daughters, Holly and Ashley, grew into teenagers. Once again, the family dynamic was shifting. When Ashley was 16, she struck up a relationship with a boy called Gordon Harding. Originally, she met him over the internet. Ashley became pregnant.
It was Joanne that got really annoyed about it. And it was my dad that was like, look, she's having a baby. We need to help her and definitely support her.
Tony managed to get Ashley and her boyfriend, Gordon Harding, into a flat owned by his brother. In November 2009, a baby daughter arrived. But the marriage between Tony and Joe was becoming increasingly strained. Tony told family and friends there were arguments centred on the way the girls were being brought up. Joe had partially moved out of the bungalow, but on more than one occasion when she came round, tensions flared, and he called the police.
I'm sorry, but I really need your help.
Joe admitted to police she picked up a knife during one row, but said she never intended to use it.
He was like a broken man, you know, he couldn't believe that the situation had got that bad, but it had, and the police asked them to leave.
Both Joe and 15-year-old Holly moved out of the family home and into the flat where Ashley, Gordon and their daughter had been living.
It stinks.
Well, you've got your father to thank for this.
They went to live with his parents. It was 2 weeks before Christmas 2009. From this point on, relations with Joe and Tony's younger daughters soured rapidly. Tensions focused particularly on money. Without telling Joe, Tony cashed in a £9,000 insurance policy. He kept most of the money in the bank, but put about £1,000 in the bedroom safe, which Joe believed still contained her jewellery. On the 2nd of February 2010, Joe visited the bungalow to collect some mail. She asked Tony for access to the safe.
I'm not going to ask you again. Give me the key.
No point.
The safe, unbeknown to me at the time, had become an issue because before it was always open, but it was never locked from the rest of the family.
There's no jewellery, I sold it.
You've sold it! You Anthony!
Tony called the police, though he didn't lodge a formal complaint. His older daughters weren't aware at first of how isolated their father, now over 60, had become.
I became increasingly worried about him. He needed money but didn't know how to fill out any forms, and he just started to sound more and more low, and he was lonely, and he was talking about Holly and how he'd seen her in the town, in the street, and she just walked as if she didn't even know him, didn't look at his face, and you know how it broke him. He'd had a nervous breakdown and he needed us to go and, you know, help him, or he needed help anyway.
It was April 2010. When she saw her father, Tony had decided he wanted to change his will as Joe wasn't coming back. Claire took him to the solicitors and was in for a shock.
Are you coming in?
Of course.
Then you need to prepare yourself. That's your stuff. I've not told you.
In 2005, Tony had changed his will. Claire and Mandy would get only the legal minimum a child can claim. Joe would be the main beneficiary.
Any property or monies or anything that he had would go to her, and the girls, Ashley and Holly, and Mandy and I would be allowed to pick a item from the property that belonged to him. And I said to him, you know, I'm so angry with you. I can't believe, you know, all my life I've loved you like I do, and Mandy, and cared for you, and yet you have to see the situation that we might have been coming to your funeral, and, you know, and been told after that basically we meant nothing to you, and that's how much, you know, that's what that signifies.
Tony ripped up the will and created a new one, leaving everything equally split between all four daughters and excluding Jo.
Bit of a turning point. He realised that, you know, we were there to help.
We went Father's Day and picked him up and brought him back down in the van. And basically he came and stayed with my sister for the first few days, and then he came over to stay with me. And it was lovely to have him.
I can't remember the last time that it ever was that good to have him there.
Back in Colwyn Bay, Jo suggested Ashley, Gordon and their daughter move into the bungalow whilst Tony was away. Claire heard washing had been seen on the line and rang the bungalow. Ashley answered. She asked Claire to keep Tony down south. What she said made Claire suspicious.
Well, don't tell him we're all here.
She basically asked me to lie to him and say that she wasn't there.
I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to lie.
Look, you know what he's like.
He might think I'm going through his paperwork or something.
Well, why would he think that? Just don't go through his stuff.
Mandy drove him home.
We walked in, the house smelt.
Oh my God.
There was a bad smell, like an old curry, and also there was dirty dog food dishes everywhere. And I remember thinking, oh no, you're going crazy, my dad, with all this mess, because he was a bit fastidious like that.
Oh, here we go again.
The next thing is Holly ran up to my dad and put her arms around him. And you could see my dad's face, because, I mean, Holly hadn't spoke to him in 6 months.
Mandy stayed the night.
Hi, Dad.
Tony had quickly found evidence that, as Claire had suspected after talking to Ashley, someone had been looking through his paperwork.
They've been going through my stuff.
Oh.
They've moved the safe.
Well, you've got to say something, Dad.
He went, no, I'm not going to make a fuss. He said, but, you know, just letting you know that I know they've been rooting through my stuff.
Hi, Dad.
Back in Hampshire, on Tuesday, July the 6th, Mandy and Claire both phoned him to check he was OK. Tony told Mandy that Ashley had been hateful in an argument over money.
But Dad, everybody's getting driving lessons. Only £500.
One lesson
pounds,
at a time.
Dad, you could easily give that money. Easily, Dad!
At 9 o'clock that night, Tony went to the pub. He came home again at 11:45 p.m. He gave Ashley £23 for the driving lessons.
But if you're going to stay here, there's going to have to be some ground rules.
But he reminded her of how her mother had left in December after he'd called the police.
You know what happened to your mother at Christmas? You'll go the same way.
Thanks.
He went to bed and can have had no idea as to what this night would bring. ...61-year-old Tony Robinson had returned from a visit to his two eldest daughters to find his bungalow in Colwyn Bay had been taken over by his younger daughters, Holly and Ashley, and their boyfriends, Gordon and Sasha. Ashley had already made it clear she'd hoped he'd stay away. 13 days later, on Wednesday, July the 7th, 2010, his daughter Claire received a visit from police.
Hi.
Hi.
Are you Claire Robinson?
Yeah.
You haven't got something awful to tell me, have you?
I remember them. They looked at each other and they just said, can we come in, please?
Do you know Anthony David Robinson?
It was like an out-of-body kind of experience, because I just remember falling to my knees on the floor. As he went on talking, he was trying to explain to me what had happened. And I just said to him, you can't tell me. You can't tell me, because I can't take it that somebody's hurt him. So you can't tell me how they've hurt him.
I just didn't believe it. I just thought, no, they must have the wrong person. Do you know? They must have the wrong person.
Police emergency, how may I help you?
At 1:39 that morning, police had received a 999 call from Juwan Barr.
Okay, what's that going on
there? Somebody's been stabbed.
Somebody has been or yeah. is being?
Has.
Has?
Yeah.
Juwan was calling the police from Tony's bungalow. And she was reporting that Tony had been stabbed by her daughter's boyfriend, a lad called Gordon Harding. Joanne did tell us she hadn't been in the bungalow when Tony had been stabbed, but she had arrived there following a call from her daughter.
Have you seen him with a knife in him then, have you?
No, I've seen the blood.
She said Tony had threatened Ashley, Gordon and the baby.
OK, the office is there now?
Yep.
All right, then. Are they in the house?
Yep.
OK.
When you listen to the call, it's quite shocking that there's no emotion there, that a person's dead a few feet away from her.
PC Rian Evans, the officer on the scene, found Ashley, Gordon, Holly and Sasha in the living room, all hugging each other.
Almost immediately, it was clear to Rian that Tony was no longer alive. She arrested Gordon Harding on suspicion of murdering Tony Robinson.
Police were confronted by a room full of people who all corroborated what Joe had told police on the phone.
You're faced with these unusual facts that there are five people in the lounge of a house, and a few feet away, Tony's lying dead. And on the face of it, it's a simple story that there's been a fight. And we've got to look at that and not accept things on face value. We've got to pick at that and we've got to try and discover the truth.
Tony's wounds spoke of an attack of extreme violence. He'd been stabbed 15 times, front and back. Four wounds passed completely through sections of his body. His hands were cut, as if he tried to fend off his knife-wielding attacker.
Gordon told us that once the fight, as he described it, had finished, he undressed within Anthony's room, and not only had he taken his clothes off, but he'd had the state of mind to fold them up with the knives nicely positioned on the top.
Gordon was taken to St. Asaph Police Station and interviewed as a suspect. The other four were taken to Colwyn Bay Police Station and interviewed separately as witnesses. They gave broadly similar accounts of what had happened. The day after the killing, Joe described two conversations, one with Ashley, the other with Holly.
Ashley said to me yesterday, I think your jewellery is in that safe, and I think mine and Holly's is as well, because he carries that key so close, Mum, it has to be. And I went, but I wouldn't worry about it, no. I want to know if he has sold your jewellery, Mum. She said, and I'm going to go in it tonight. She said, I'm going up to Dad's, and I went, what for?
So who said this?
Holly.
Right.
I said, what for? Because Ashley's going to go in the safe, and I want to have a look. I went, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think you should go.
All those interviewed said Ashley, Gordon and the baby had been alone in the bungalow when Tony returned from the pub. Holly, Sasha and Joe said they were all at the flat a mile away at the time of the attack. They said when Tony was asleep, Ashley and Gordon, who was armed with a commando knife as a deterrent, had crept into the room to get at jewellery in the safe.
As we walked in, he got out of bed, my dad got out of bed and said, oh no, you don't, I'm not having this, I'm going to do you, I'm going to do you all.
All those interviewed agreed Tony had threatened Ashley and the baby. They said when Tony woke, Gordon, terrified, dropped the knife and Ashley fled. Tony picked up a kitchen knife lying beside the bed and lunged at Gordon. In the ensuing struggle, Tony was stabbed by Gordon in self-defence. Gordon said he then emerged and spoke briefly to Ashley.
He's dead, Ashley.
I said, oh, go and get a shower. I'm going to ring my mum. And I rang my mum and said, mum, dad's dead. And she said, you're joking. Fuck off, you're joking. And that's what she said. So it's a bad language. And then she said, do you want me to come up? And I went, yeah, please.
And my mum got a phone call off my sister. And all I heard from my mum's side of the conversation was, you're fucking joking me. And then I'm not sure what the response was from my sister, but my mum went, oh my God, you're serious. And she hung up and she said to me and Sasha, she said, get your coats on, come on, we're going.
They all said Joe then drove with Holly and Sasha to the house.
We got to the bungalow and Ashley said to my mum, you don't want to go in there. And my mum went into my dad's room anyway. And she came out and she was white and she said, go into the lounge and just wait there. I've got to ring the police.
The problem for police was there were small differences in the detail of each of their stories.
So we were going into the bedroom to check if it was if the safe was unlocked.
Very early on in all of those accounts and those interviews, none of the accounts were adding up, quite clearly. They weren't telling us the truth.
For instance, Gordon's story did not quite tally with Ashley's account. She said she'd never seen the knife Gordon alleged Tony had used, and she described a longer conversation when Gordon emerged from the bedroom.
He said, I'm really sorry, Ash, but your dad's dead. I didn't mean to kill him, but he really upset me with what he said.
Furthermore, the accounts of the fight didn't match what was found at the scene.
Gordon had described a violent struggle with Tony. The crime scene investigators were finding no evidence of that in Tony's bedroom. The ornaments were still on the bedside cabinet. Clothing wasn't disturbed. And blood that Tony had lost during the course of the attack was really confined to the bed itself. It certainly appeared to me at that time that Tony had been overpowered on the bed by either one or more of his attackers.
It just seemed that nothing was clear, that they were lying. You know, and once we heard, like, knives were involved and stuff like that, I just began to feel that it, you know, it was eerie, it just didn't feel right.
Gordon was the only person against whom there was clear forensic evidence at the scene.
Gordon's clothes were sent for a forensic examination, and the results we came back were not what you'd expect if you were to believe his version of events. There was very little blood on the T-shirt he was wearing. There was no bloody handprints or smears of blood you'd expect to find if people were fighting and someone had been stabbed. Yet on his trousers, on the inside of the leg area, a massive amount of blood was found, which led the scientists to believe that at some point he'd actually straddled Tony so that the blood was transferred onto his clothing.
Forensic examination of the knives showed they had Tony's blood on them, as well as tissue or fatty residue, a strong indication both knives were used. But despite discrepancies between the forensic evidence and what Gordon and Ashley had said, there was still nothing to challenge the broad account given by the five people interviewed.
It was becoming quite frustrating because we just couldn't get a consistent account. So we started to look at where we could try and establish some fact around exactly what had happened.
They turned to CCTV, What they found deepened their suspicion. There was no sign of Joe's car heading to the bungalow after the killing.
When Joanne had first contacted the police, she told us that she'd received a message from Ashley to come up to Tony's bungalow. She told us that she'd left her flat in Colwyn Bay and travelled to Tony's bungalow in her car with Holly and Sasha. So we knew that if we looked at the CCTV, we'd be able to plot her movements in a car. It was only when we started looking at that CCTV footage that we couldn't find her car on the route that she told us she'd taken. So we started extending those parameters on the CCTV footage, and what we found was that Joanne's car was on the CCTV footage, but it was significantly earlier than we had expected.
But it was evidence from another technological quarter that was to blow the original story apart. At the time of the arrest, police seized mobile phones. They examined text messages exchanged between all the people in the house in the run-up to the killing.
We were overwhelmed with what we found in some of the messages and some of the detail contained within those phones.
Many of the texts related to an issue which had been at the core of tensions between Tony and others in his family. Money. The killing happened at 1 a.m. on Wednesday, July the 7th. The messages began the previous day, Tuesday the 6th.
Holly, please calm down.
Together with records of times at which phone calls were made, they reveal a very different story to the one clearly concocted by the group at the house before police arrived. And they give a unique insight, at times charting events minute by minute, into the build-up to a terrible crime involving two daughters and their own father. For this film, we've dramatised the text message exchanges. The first was from Gordon to Joe.
I know what's in the safe. It's cold hard cash. I need to get in. He's still saying he has no money.
There followed a flurry of phone calls between Joe, Ashley and Holly, monitoring Tony's movements as a plan began to take shape.
Is Dad back yet?
He is now.
Go in the safe! At night!
Text messages showed that afternoon, Holly, Ashley and Joe saw each other in Colwyn Bay town centre.
You're the only one living with him. We're not living with him.
We were able to establish that Ashley, Holly and Joe had met to discuss going into Tony's bedroom and to take jewellery and the contents from the safe.
Ashley returned to the bungalow. The messages continued.
I'm going to kill him.
Why?
Bring me.
Ashley then spoke for 8 minutes to Holly.
There's no talking to him, there's no reasoning with him.
Their resolve hardened.
No, I am. It's game on.
We're getting the big guns out.
By 9 p.m, Tony was in the pub. The daughters mapped out how the raid on Tony's safe should happen. Holly was insistent she and her boyfriend Sasha Roberts should be present, but Ashley said they should stay away.
Ashley, we are not. We're coming with you.
The conversation continued via text.
I knew you'd do that. What? Not let me come.
It's just dangerous, Holly.
I can look out for myself.
Yeah, fine. I'll let you in then.
Cool. You're not going to help at all?
Probably not.
Why? You want it as much as me.
As we started to gather some of this evidence, their status as witnesses had changed, and they were, in fact, suspects for Tony's murder.
The girls waited for Tony to come back from the pub, the keys to the safe in his pocket.
He's home.
We'll be on our way up soon.
There's then a 13-minute gap in the texting, during which, according to Ashley, Tony gave her the money for driving lessons and food.
It's going to have to be some ground.
Then came an exchange referring to the incident in December 2009, when Tony and Joe argued and he called the police, which led to Joe and Holly leaving.
Dad just said that he got rid of Mum at Christmas and he'll do the same to me because it ain't working out. By the way, he's drinking coffee.
He's threatening to kick her out.
The boys were psyching themselves up.
Sash, he goes tonight. Need your backup, ready when you are.
We're on our way. Hang tight.
The text messages demolished the claim by Joe, Holly and Sasha that they stayed at the flat during the killing.
Evidence like this is gold dust. We are able to show people that they're lying to us. And we were able to show them their own words and their own planning.
It's gone. Keep your mouth shut and your phone on silent.
Ring me!
We can't. What's up?
We're on our way. We're going to jump over the front gate. No houses, no witnesses.
Okay. We're just getting dropped off by Sandhills.
Joe let Holly and Sasha out of the car a few yards from the bungalow. Sasha had with him the commando knife. Joe then moved her vehicle to a car park a short distance away to wait.
Gate. Wait at the bottom of the hill.
She wants us to wait at the bottom of the hill.
No way.
Wait 5 minutes. Gordon will text you next.
We're by the kitchen window.
He has his light on, I think.
Don't move. 2 minutes.
Light is off. Come.
There was one more text message that night, before Joe came up to the house.
Things happened. Dad is no more. Sorry, Mum.
The text messages left those in the house with nowhere to hide. What they subsequently revealed laid bare much more of the truth about what happened that night. Police investigating the killing of Tony Robinson had recovered incriminating text messages between his two youngest daughters, their mother and their boyfriends. They were furious that Tony had refused to move out of the family home. Other details emerged about what had happened in the immediate run-up to the murder, including remarks made to various people by Joe.
Oh, I tell you what, I could absolutely kill him.
Joanne, Ashley and Holly believed that Tony had retained jewellery. As you would probably expect in an acrimonious split like this, Tony had told them that he'd sold this jewellery.
Two ladies of a similar age to Joanne and Ashley had actually been into a local jeweller's in Colwyn Bay trying to establish whether or not Tony had actually sold jewellery, which they believed was theirs. We were never able to establish whether that was actually Joanne or Ashley, but I think it's fair to say it probably was.
Also, Ashley had found paperwork relating to the money Tony received after cashing in his life insurance policy.
We've got a text message from Ashley saying, "I know what's in the safe, it's cold hard cash."
Joe wrongly speculated that what Tony had cashed in was their joint endowment policy.
She went as far as to contact Eagle Star, who were the endowment holding company for the house, to find out if he'd cashed that endowment in.
No, I need to know today.
That was about 12 to 14 hours before he died.
When police checked Tony's safe, the focus of the abortive raid, it contained £900. It was the text messages which blew the cover story apart. Only Gordon, who'd already admitted the stabbing, stuck to the original version. Ashley said her text saying she was going to kill her father had been an empty threat. Holly now admitted she'd been in the house. And Sasha, who had learning difficulties, gave graphic testimony of witnessing the murder itself moments after he'd handed the commando knife to Gordon.
I saw him with his arm like that, leaning over the bed. And I don't know if it was me imagining it in my head or just like actually seeing it happen. I don't know if I was...
It's okay, Sasha, take a moment.
Just take the time, mate.
He's been picturing it when he shuts his eyes.
Okay, take your time, Sasha.
Throughout, Jo distanced herself from the others and from the violence against Tony.
I said, I don't think you should go, Holly. I really don't think you should go. I said, because if your dad wakes up, if you go in there when your dad's asleep and your dad wakes up, you are going to freak out. He's going to go skit and you are going to freak out.
Joanne Barr was the hardest person I've ever interviewed in 22 years in the police. She was very cold towards what had happened. She had her own agenda to look after herself. Her answers were obstructive and aggressive, and she was only in that room to cover her own back and didn't care that her daughters had been arrested or their boyfriends had been arrested. And I came out of that interview room shattered.
Jo said the plan had purely been to get the jewellery. She did admit telling everyone what to say.
Gordon did it out of defending you, OK? It was self-defence.
Although we still hadn't obtained a consistent account between all five individuals, we'd managed to gather sufficient evidence to present to the CPS. We had established that Holly and Ashley and their boyfriends were in Tony's bungalow when Tony had been murdered. We were able to establish that they were all aware of the presence of the commando knife. And we presented this evidence to CPS and ultimately all four were charged with Tony's murder. We were also able to gather sufficient evidence which demonstrated that the five of them, including Joanne, had all conspired to pervert the course of justice in an effort to throw the police off the scent.
The trial at Mould Crown Court lasted a month. The four young defendants denied murder. Gordon admitted using the knife, but said he'd done so in self-defence. The jury didn't believe any of them. In February 2011, they were found guilty. All of them, except Gordon, admitted the conspiracy charge, as did Jo. Gordon was convicted on that count. Gordon and Ashley were sentenced to a minimum of 22 years, Sasha to 20 and Holly to 18. Jo, described as thoroughly wicked by the judge, was sentenced to 6 years, reduced to four, because she'd pleaded guilty.
I came out of the courtroom physically trembling. I realised very quickly that their actions had caused them to be sentenced to more time in prison than they'd actually been alive.
All those convicted appealed against sentence. And in May 2011, the appeals were summarily thrown out.
This is a really, really sad case. The one place that you're supposed to feel safe in is your own home. The people you're supposed to be safe around are your family. Anthony's family plotted against him, entered his home and killed him.
What happened on that night has affected three generations of the same family. I feel for Tony's family that are left to try and manage the rest of their lives without Tony and younger members of their family around.
You have visions, don't you? You think of all the terrible things, you know, think, did they tie him up? Did they torture him? You know, did he open his eyes? Did he see his own daughters? You don't know, do you? And that is the worst bit, because they still won't tell the truth.
They just murdered him, and they left him there. And this person, our father, the kindest, you know, the kindest person you'd ever meet. He was so gentle and warm and loving. Nobody hugged him. Nobody put a blanket over him. Nobody did anything. They just left him there. They just murdered him. And then they left him there. And the first thing they did was conspire and try and blame him and try and get themselves off. And just think that I just can't forgive him for that.